This is Whiskey Wanderlust.
And we're on an expedition to discover how Colorado is elevating craft spirits from grain to glass.
We bring whiskey explorers like you an inside look at the distilled stories, colorful characters, and rich flavors that make Colorado a true whiskey frontier.
So, pour yourself a dram.
And join us on an unforgettable journey.
On this episode, Distillery 291.
Welcome to Whiskey Wanderlust, the Colorado Spirits Expedition. We're your hosts, Corey and Ryan, and we're going to introduce you to our second episode today, which we're super excited about. Who are we meeting with?
Today, we are talking to 291, and we are speaking with, it's an interview with Michael Myers, who's the owner, and Eric Jett, who is the head distiller at 291.
Or as chief scientist. His title changes routinely throughout the episode, yes, but... This is a local distillery for us here in Colorado Springs, and Michael Myers started this up 13 years ago, and we are just a couple weeks past his 13th anniversary.
Yep. So 291's 13th anniversary was in September.
Yep,
and September 11th, as we'll find out the significance behind.
Yes,
that.
Yep. Well, and I mean, Michael has had quite a journey to get to where he's at today. Mm-hmm. Former fashion photographer, lived in New York. 9/11 played a big role for him and his migration from New York to Colorado, and decided, reading an article, that he would start a whiskey brand, right? And I think his words were, how hard could it be?
Yeah.
And as Eric's,
and I think as it turns out, really damn hard. Really.
So, and Eric affirmed that, right?
Yeah.
And they're kind of unconventional meeting too, meeting, doing some things in the industry together. And it's really fascinating to see Michael having written down in a journal that, you know, wanted to work with Eric one day after meeting him.
Yeah.
And then a year or two passed and ended up, I think it was a little longer than that, but
yeah,
to bring them together. But two really humble people. And as you'll see, Michael Myers is a true artist at heart. He wears his emotions on his sleeve. It's just a great guy. Eric Jett, I mean, the two of them are just a great pair. And so what stood out to you?
I think just Michael's passion. Because like you said, he's a true artist. And not only... like speaking through the whiskey, because the whiskey is really good, but also just it really shows in the care and the experimentation that he went through, and you know, just kind of I'm gonna not let things prohibit me from trying this out,
you know,
and he just kind of DIY'd it until he created something really great.
Yeah.
So it was really impressive.
Well, and then like Eric, you know, came from a printing background and ended up breaking into distilling at Stranahan's, and anyways, their meeting though is kind of serendipitous, and I think the two of them work really, really, really well together. And they're doing some cool things. They're specialists in high proof whiskeys, right? You're not going to get anything that's a standard 90 proof, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're going to get, you know, you're looking at 120 or better in a lot of their spirits.
Yeah. As we find out in the episode, this is the good stuff.
Yes,
and it's not just Michael saying it.
Right? Yes, that's true.
Yeah,
And they're doing also some unconventional things, which some of them maybe have become a little bit more urban legend a little bit. And other things, you know, that people have said that they couldn't do. But they're doing it, and they're doing it very well. And it was a great interview with them. And Eric, man, we've had some good tastings so far, but Eric led quite a tasting for us.
Yeah, that was really great.
A 5-course tasting with highest proof spirits. It was we really enjoyed that one. So it was a lot of fun. So
stick around at the end of the episode to either listen to or watch that tasting at the end of the episode.
And there's several nuggets in this particular tour which you will not want to miss, including how the still was made, the history behind the materials and the plates in which Michael used. Mm-hmm. Super fascinating, and I won't get into too much, but the spirits pass through New York on their way to your bottle. So anyways, super fascinating. Here we go. All right. Well, welcome to Whiskey Wanderlust. We're here at Distillery 291 with Michael Myers and Eric Jett. I'm Corey. This is Ryan. And we are really excited about this today. Guys, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. We're excited. Yeah.
And thanks for having us.
Appreciate it. Absolutely.
Glad to have you.
Well, we just wrapped up the tour with you, right? And you walked through a lot of cool stuff. But the one thing we didn't really talk about, right, was your origins. Like, you talked about it a little bit, but not really in detail, right? But you started your career as a fashion photographer.
I did. I born and raised in Georgia, and my mom moved to California when I was 6, and I spent my summers in California a little bit. And she's an interior designer, and I thought I was going to be that, and or interested in architecture actually. And when I was 15, turning 16, the Christmas of I was 15, she gave me a camera, an Olympus OM-10, a Cheryl Teagues camera, and I picked it up and never put it down.
That's awesome.
And so, went to Savannah College of Art and Design for photography and graduated there, and then moved back to Atlanta for a year, and then California for 5, and then New York for 13.
And quite, as I understand, a fairly prolific career, correct?
Sure. Yes, I had a very nice career. It wasn't the level, it didn't reach the level that I had hoped it would. It was headed that way when I pivoted, and 9/11 changed my life, and then I had to pivot at 10 years later about. So
go ahead and tell us, since we're talking about 9/11, go ahead and tell us a little bit about that experience.
So
you were living just blocks away from the towers, correct?
Yeah, 3 blocks from World Trade. I was lived on Warren and West Side Highway, 25th floor, and my kids went to, or my oldest was in school on the 2nd floor, and we dropped him off at school, and then walking to Washington Market School for my younger, who was a day old 4 that day, and we stepped in Duane off of Greenwich, and the first plane was scraping buildings coming in and hit the World Trade. I didn't actually see it hit. I saw the aftermath of the fireball coming out because I was inside the block and the building was blocking me, so I had to run out. So crazy day. Couldn't get back in our building. Went to Long Island friend's house the next day, the night of 9/11, which is kind of interesting. Erickson Place is the north side of the building. Mm-hmm. And the Brandy Library is in the bottom of that building. And so spent the night there with like 7 families. And at the time, I don't think the Brandy Library was there. And so in 2018, I won World's Best Rye Whiskey from Whiskey Magazine. We have to win World's or America's Best first. And so I did. And I went to New York to accept that award. And it was at the Brandy Library. So it was really interesting how much it was a full circle.
Uh-huh.
That here, 9/11 changed my life to where I started making whiskey, in a sense. And winning this award, I'm being given it in the same building. So that was really poignant and just kind of crazy.
At that stage, had you moved on from photography and gone into whiskey full time?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I had been.
So really bookended your two
exactly
distinct chapters of your life.
Yeah. So this was 2018. I did win America's Best No Age Statement from Whiskey Magazine in 2016, first time presented. And they sent me an email and said, you should come, Brandy Library or whatever. And I was like, they're just paper in the seats. Why would they ask me to come? And so I did. We won America's Best. 2017, we were like 4th. 2018, America's and then World's Best. So 2017, I went. I met Jeff Arnett. He was master distiller of Jack Daniels at that time. So it was, full circle, kind of crazy.
And I think, there was a span of 17 years that you kind of condensed there. When did you actually open up Distillery 291?
Yeah, so I read the article. It was an article that Stephen Goss wrote about creating Hendrix Gin and Sailor Jerry in the New York Times. I was shooting Vanity Fair in New York, flying back, and I read this article And I was looking for something to do. And that's when I thought I could, you know, it was August 2010. I thought I could brand a whiskey. And I came back and talked to Mike Bristol, Bristol Brewing Company here in Colorado Springs. He was a friend. And he said, you know, get your license. I'll try and help. I can brew beer. I don't know anything about distillation. And I said, I'll figure that out. And so, sure. Being from Georgia, they make it in the woods. How hard could it be? And so
turns out kind of hard.
And your master distiller right here.
So I started in 300 square feet, could make 60 gallons a month. Eric Jett, my head distiller now. I met him
2011. About a week or two like after you started distilling.
After I distilled.
Yeah.
I went to Denver to Distillers Guild tasting at Stranahan's and had white whiskeys in a bottle. You know, I didn't have anything aged yet. And he came out with Rob Dietrich and a few other guys and tasted my White Dog. And
it was great. I mean, I told him it was the best White Dog I'd ever tried. Oh. Like, I was like, this is great. I can't wait to see it aged. And talked about tasting notes and just kind of hit it off. And we'd see each other at different events, different industry things over the years, you know, became friends. And he always told me he'd try to hire me one day, and eventually he did. So
okay. Yeah, I was in 300 square feet for 3 years, so it took a little while to get there. But in my notebook, in the gutter, it says, met Eric, hopefully he can work, we can work together one day.
That's awesome. That was 2011. We started working together 2014, January of 2014. So
So then tell us about your background. Like, how did you get here?
Mine's not nearly as cool as Michael's. I was a screen printer for a while, like 5 years or something. It was good, but you know, it's kind of in the background thinking, what do I want to do with my life? Not sure. My wife and I both really enjoyed whiskey. We'd have, you know, little whiskey parties at our house and stuff. And so back in 2010, for one of our wedding anniversaries, we took the day off of work and we went and did a bunch of things. And one of the things we did was toured Stranahan's distillery, which was at the time one of our favorite whiskeys. And had never thought about making whiskey. I always enjoyed drinking it, but you know, you read bottles and it by distillers, and it sounds like you got to be born into this family, like somebody's like great great grandson inherited this distillery. Like, you got to live in Kentucky and be this, you know, part of this family. Never thought it was for me, but went there that day, saw it being made, and I was like, this is amazing. This is so cool. So updated my resume and continued to harass Stranahan's for almost a year until they brought me on and learned on the job there, worked with them for about 3 years. And that was while I was working there that I met Michael. And in 2014, we started working together. So
really, like, I met you at a whiskey event. And we were actually at Stranahan's, which is kind of funny enough, right?
There was a
Stranahan's one. And so we talked about that, which is kind of fun. But before we move on too far, I do want to ask you, obviously 9/11 is a huge deal and we all have, you know, emotions with that. And we all speak to where we were in the event, but you being there, seeing the aftermath, how does that change your life? And how did, like, what prompted you to come this way?
Big questions. What prompted me was my ex-wife's parents lived here. We couldn't get into our apartment. It was a nightmare. And so we decided to move here for, we thought a month, and early on, Aaron, day two or whatever, is like, I got to put my kids in school so they have a normal life. And she did. And it was a good thing she did. And so we ended up staying for the 9 months, and then we moved back to Colorado. Back to New York and lived there for a couple more years. And it just wasn't good for my kids or my wife at the time. She had an emergency bag packed at the door, you know,
ready to go.
It was crazy. So it changes your life.
Drama.
And so it's like, okay, what's best for my family? And so we moved back. School, everything was better. And so we moved back and I commuted, and that was like, okay, I'm commuting weekly, almost 3 weeks out of the month in New York. And, you know, and it just got to a point where I was like, this isn't good for my family either. I need to either be there or we need to, you know, go back to New York. And that wasn't going to happen. So that's when I really started looking.
And turns out Colorado Springs doesn't have a big fashion beauty scene here.
It's true. There's a lot of landscape
Or Denver.
Or Denver.
Yeah.
A lot of adventure Instagram influencers, right? That's
yeah.
Right.
That was, yeah, but that didn't exist.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's true.
A lot of landscape photographers.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I have a few of those.
Yeah. Kind of beautiful ones at that. That's for sure. You. Yes, absolutely.
So then what was the what inspired you to make that change and to make that jump going from the art world and what you know into the whiskey world?
Literally that article. So, I mean, I had looked at like running some of the galleries here, or, you know, there's a couple of museums or, you know, can't even think of the names here. But I even put in a resume or two at those, and just nobody was interested in me as that. And, what am I going to do? Be a used car salesman? Mm-hmm. No, that's not creative. I mean, for me.
Right.
And you know, even the ad agencies in Denver and stuff here were like, oh, you know, he's a fashion photographer. He's got an attitude. He's going to, you guys have met me. I don't fit that.
The preconception.
Absolutely. Preconception. it had to be something that was going to be creative, but also something that I didn't have to be there every day. Because as a photographer, you have to be there every day to make money.
Right.
Something I can pass on to my kids, because you can't really pass on anything, you know, photography. You can pass on the negatives, and sort of if you're like Annie Leibovitz, you'll make some money after that.
Right.
So those were the criteria, and I read this, you know, and I liked whiskey, and I grew up on a farm, and I, you know, cows and horses, and I liked the West. I was the Western saddle in our barn with all English, you know, other saddles. And I just was like, I, you know, read this article, and I was like, well, I could brand a whiskey, you know, I could brand a tequila, you know, and tequila you can only make in, you know, like champagne. Region. And the interesting thing about that is I went through my mom living in California in the 70s and all, and the white wine of California, the sparkling white wine, you couldn't call it champagne, and it was really hard to sell and brand and all.
Yeah.
And so I learned about all that. And so that was like, okay, agave spirit? No. Whiskey? Yes. Okay. Can I make it in California? Because family lives there. I could live where, you know, and I was like, California whiskey. That doesn't sound great. Georgia whiskey. That's not working.
More like Georgia moonshine, right?
And so Colorado whiskey is sexy, right?
Absolutely.
And so that's where I landed. I lived here. I also didn't realize that building a brick and mortar business, because I was a freelance photographer, I could live anywhere.
Right.
Building brick and mortar, you're stuck where you know.
Right.
And so I'm here. None of my family lives in Colorado Springs anymore. Right. And I'm here.
That's awesome. So heart and soul of an artist right here, right? And you come at this from a much different angle. And you said, figured how hard it could be. I think your head scientist here might argue it's harder than you.
My title keeps changing. That was definitely inaccurate.
No. So scientist. Pull back the veil a little bit, right? Let's talk about, like, I mean,
this is just as much of an art to me as it is to him. I don't have the career as an artist, but I am no scientist, let me assure you.
I think I'm more of a scientist than he is.
But so tell us, I mean, and you've been around a while, right? How long have you been with 291 now?
10 years this month.
10 years.
Wow. Okay. This is my 10-month anniversary this month. 10 year so anniversary
were,
this
like,
month.
You were barely putting an aged product in a bottle before he joined you.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Moved out of 300 square foot space.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've been here this, like, what is from your perspective, right? Being crafting this, what's your proudest moment for the distillery in your mind?
So an easy answer would be things like World's Best Rye or really big awards. You know, we've won lots of awards, but I don't think it's anything, one thing like that. For me, when I left Stranahan's, when I wanted to be working with Michael, I was very much considering where I wanted to work. And 291 was pretty much, that's the only place I could see myself working at that time in the Colorado landscape, because Michael was making something unique and something delicious. And I think the proudest thing, the thing I'm most proud of about 291 is that we've been able to make something that is totally unique. Our bourbon doesn't taste like a Kentucky bourbon. Our rye doesn't taste like a Kentucky rye, but it's also not weird. You know, there's sometimes you taste a whiskey, you're like, that's different, but different in not necessarily a good way.
Right.
Ours is different in a very good way. Mm-hmm. And I love that if you want this flavor profile, you got to drink 291 to get it. We've been able to make something different and make something delicious and really stand out in a sea of a lot of amazing whiskeys, but some of them are all, you know, pretty similar. And I think that's probably the thing I'm most proud of over these 10 years.
So what are some of the unique ways that you're preparing and you're distilling and finishing these whiskeys?
I mean, so we do our Aspen Stave finish. A lot of people think that that is what makes our whiskey stand out. We were the first distillery to ever use aspen as a finishing wood for whiskey. And it does, it changes the whiskey a little bit, but it is very subtle. I tell people, look, by the time you get to the point where aspen stave finishing at the end of the aging process, the cake's already been baked. This is just the icing on top. Mm. You know, we're using malted rye. Michael was the first person I ever heard of that was using malted rye in making whiskey. This specific type of yeast we're using is very unique. The shape of the stills that Michael created and the way we make our cuts those.
That original still is one of a kind. So
yeah. And then there's the,
and the stripping still.
The stripping still too, yeah. But all of our stills are made here in Colorado Springs. They're very DIY. You're not going to find another still that looks like it. And the way we make our cuts, the climate that we're aging in is very dry. We're not climate controlling our any of our warehouses. So much of that goes into making a whiskey that tastes unique before we even do that last step of the process. But
for our viewers and our listeners, Michael made his original still from copper plates from photography processing. I would butcher the word that you pronounce.
it's a French word, photogravure.
Okay.
You'll have to photo etching.
You'll have to refer to the tour on YouTube for that and to see it, and you'll get to see it in person, which would be great. So
yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about how you decided to use those to create your first still.
So that's funny because I talked about Vendome making my condensers. So I knew I needed a still and I went to Vendome and asked, you know, how much is a 50-gallon still? And they were like, well, we have one, it's electric and it's 50 grand. And I'm like, I've never made whiskey in my life. I don't have that kind of money. I'm, you know, and so I was like, I grew up on a farm. I'm an artist. I've sweat copper. I mean, I think I could build something. And so I was like, well, I need copper. And I had done this show in Tribeca with these photogravures and knew I had the copper plates. Actually, Lothar, the man that made the plates, had them. And for $100, I had them FedEx to me. And I, you know, had drawn up the still. In high school, I had 15 or 11 quarters of drafting in high school. So mechanical drafting. So I can draft a little bit. So I broke those skills out and came up with the measurements and everything. And took them to Western Steel here in Colorado Springs and had them water jet cut, you know, my pattern. And then took them to another place and me and another guy hand rolled them through a roller to curve them. And then took them to Al Novak, rest his soul. He's an amazing welder man and he's no longer with us, but he TIG welded it all together for me. And I had sourced all the parts, the sight glass and different things. And
the first time you did a run on that still was
September 11th, 2011,
10 years to the day. After.
Wow.
That's awesome.
September 11th. Yeah.
Coincidence or deliberate?
Well, sort of. I took the rolled copper to Al early in the summer and he hadn't TIG welded copper in a while and it's really a hard process. And so he kept putting it off and doing other things. And I'd show up and I'd be like, Al, are you going to work on my still? And he's like, yeah, come back tomorrow or 2 days and we'll start it and come back. And he's like, I got this. I was like, and so finally I got to a point and I didn't realize it, but I said, Al, I got to have the still. I've got a space and I've got to make whiskey. And he's like, oh, it's costing you money. And I was like, yes, it costs me. And that clicked. And he's like, come Monday and we'll start. And that was, I think he finished the still the 7th of September. And
you're just like, put off a few days. You're like,
I have the notes. Well, wait. Yeah. And I was like, why? I should wait. Let's remake that that anniversary. And so I did.
That's awesome.
Wow. Yeah.
Going back a little bit, I guess one of the coolest things about that still is there's, you know, you talked about New York, but the Chrysler Building is literally imprinted on the inside of that still. So you're even passing New York through on every bottle you make now, right?
Yeah.
Which is
so the column, inside the column, is the Chrysler Building. Also, I don't tell many people this. Every image on that still has a special meaning to it. So the Chrysler Building, because in art school you learn about that building because it's such a work of art.
Absolutely.
Jackson Hole. I won't get through it. If we start down that road, we won't finish.
Overdram another time. Yeah. Eric, pull back the veil a little bit and talk about product, right? Because, you know, when you go to craft a product, like, tell us the process that you guys go through to select the recipe, all the products that you're putting in there.
And for something new?
Yeah, something new especially, yes.
That's a collaborative thing between Michael and I. I'd say, you know, definitely mostly Michael. He's still very much in the driver's seat, his artistic vision. But we definitely will collaborate. And we have what's called our E series of whiskeys. The E, you see a big gold E on the label. The E stands for experimental.
Okay.
And that's really a line of whiskeys where we can flex our creativity and just try things out. Michael will oftentimes just, he hikes a lot, and on a hike, he'll come up with an idea like, oh, I want to try a whiskey. Like, I think soon here in a moment, we'll actually taste a whiskey that is a new experiment that we've been working on. And oftentimes it's actually released.
What we all have.
Different.
Oh yeah.
We have in our glass.
Yeah.
It's delicious.
And so oftentimes our E series is really the way that we do that. And Michael gets really intrigued with mash bills, likes to try different things out with mash bills. But we've tried different yeasts before. We've tried some different finishes. There's a lot of other distilleries doing finishes. So we're happy with our Aspen Stave finish. And mostly it's different mash bills, different fermentation processes or aging processes, things like that.
Right.
But I don't know. Yeah. You don't really know until you try it. It's right. Really difficult to be able to predict, if I make this change, I know exactly how it's going to change the whole process. Well, then, because there's a ripple effect across the whole way. You change the yeast, for example.
Right.
Now, all of a sudden, you have to make different cuts coming off your still because you have different esters that are available to, you know, the flavors that are coming off the still. So you change one variable and it changes all the variables that come after it, and you don't know until you try it.
And when it first comes off the still, I mean, are you able to taste like, oh, yes, this is good? Or is there sometimes you're just like, well, you just needs to age? Like,
you don't know what the end product's going to taste like, but you can definitely say this is going to be something good. It has a lot of promise
or
to
special.
It. Yeah, yeah. Or this isn't that great. And even if we sit on it for a while, it probably won't be that great.
Right.
You can tell.
Or maybe.
Sometimes you get surprised. Yeah.
So
you get surprised.
The big thing about that process is, and early on, it freaked Eric out. Eric's been around long enough now that it doesn't freak him out as much, but is we'll be tasting something. We'll have a couple of whiskeys that we're talking about whether they're an E or not. And this goes back a few years, and I'll have two of them in my hand and I'll pour them together. And early on,
I don't know if it freaked me out, but maybe
be like, wait, how much was what? And meaning the ratio to it. And it's like, no, we'll figure it out. If it's good, we'll figure it out. That's sure. not a problem. But now he's like, hey, we should try this. And
yeah, I mean,
we do that a lot.
That's we actually had all rye. Yeah. So the all rye right here is 100% malted rye. 50% of that rye is actually coming from Germany and 50% is coming from here in Colorado. We mashed those, distilled those, and aged those separately, wanting to compare different varietals of rye grown and malted in different regions. We liked them both. They're both very different whiskeys, just changing that one variable of where you're getting your grain. And we liked them both for different reasons. And for this particular release, we actually found we liked it when we married them together at a even ratio 50-50. And then E12, one of our more recent E releases, was actually a marrying of two different weeded bourbons. There was a weeded bourbon recipe that I wanted to try out and a weeded bourbon recipe that Michael wanted to try out. Originally thinking they were probably going to be two different E's. again, we liked them for different reasons, but when we decided to marry them together, we liked them better together than separately. And so that particular e-release is two different weeded bourbon mash bills married together.
Sounds like a good partnership.
Yeah, it is.
Right? Really good partnership.
I tend to like whiskey a little sweeter. He tends to like whiskey a little spicier. Although right now I'm drinking a rye whiskey because it's wintertime and snowing out. And man, nothing beats a rye whiskey.
This is a rye whiskey, but it's also a rye. It's a little sweeter probably than that.
Yeah.
You talk about like collaboration and artistry, and I mean, really sounds like you guys have really a true passion for this, right? Yeah. So, obviously, Kentucky is still the crown region of the United States, maybe the world for whiskey, right?
Really? Mm-hmm. I don't know about the world.
I would agree. There's some Scottish people that give you a hard time.
Well, now I'm still locked. Kentucky, who? What?
Yeah, right. <What's> exactly. Gonna... I mean, hillbillies, right? That's, you know, I start off in Scotch. So like, I totally agree. Like Scotland, for my opinion, but there's a lot of people you talk to, especially in the United States. It's like, oh no, it's Kentucky, right?
Yeah.
And you mentioned earlier, Colorado whiskey, it's sexy, right? But it goes beyond that now, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you guys, Colorado, you guys are a part of the movement now, bringing Colorado more, bringing it up on the map. Tell me, what are you guys doing? Like, how do you feel your impact's making? And what do you see the future of the industry here in Colorado?
You want to go first?
No, you can go first. I'll go first. I don't care. We are definitely making a mark. Colorado is making a mark in the whiskey world. Boulder Spirits, Laws, us, Stranahan's,
Deer Hammer, Bear Creek.
Yeah.
I mean,
Peach Street, Woody Creek, Peach Street.
Leopold. Yeah. There's too many Leopold's, names. We left you off the list. I'm sorry.
Yeah, we're not trying to leave anybody
there's,
off.
I think there's at this point around 100 licensed distillers in Colorado, somewhere around there. They're not all producing right now. We don't have anything on the shelf, but there's a lot of distilleries here in Colorado.
And they're crushing it. And they're, we're talking grain to barrel to bottle, you know, making it from scratch, not sourcing. And they're crushing it. And Colorado whiskey is a thing. And you know, it only is attracting more people in the whiskey world here, to make whiskey. All our friends in Kentucky that are starting distilleries that are, you know, making grain to barrel to bottle or sourcing, all of a sudden they're ending up on the shelves here. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, wait a minute. Why? You know, so it's kind of interesting because there's more people drinking whiskey in the South, Georgia, Kentucky, you know, Louisiana than Colorado. But there's a big push to get your bottle on the shelf in Colorado. Mm. And that says a lot.
Right.
Well, it's interesting. One of the first markets we opened outside of Colorado was Kentucky.
Yep.
That's
you know, go to the home base, like, you know, enemy territory. That's so it's not really their enemies, but like, you know, go where it's like they're proudest of their Kentucky bourbon. Like, here's a Colorado bourbon on your shelf. Like,
Yeah. Something funny about that is we had some people in the tasting room the other day, this couple, and they were, he was really funny. And I walked in and started talking to him and he's like, you know where I tasted your whiskey first. And I'm like, where? And he goes, this bar in Lexington, Kentucky. He goes, we walked in and they've got a huge selection of whiskey. And he said to the bartender, what's your favorite whiskey on the shelf? And the bartender turned around and pulled 291 off the shelf and poured it for him. The guy said, we laughed. He and his wife laughed at the bartender. And then they taste it and they're like, oh, damn. And they are working in Denver now. And they drove down because they're like, we love your whiskey from that day.
Well, that's like your story that you have, you know, like, boom, Colorado whiskey, right? That was the, that's, you know, that's your adage stuff you use, you know, that's awesome.
Yeah, walk in a bar, Western bar, this
there
is the whiskey they should put down.
You heard it here, the West starts in Kentucky, but it's hard. Parts in Colorado, right?
Yeah.
So what's your distribution now? Is it how far outside of Colorado are you guys distributing?
Pretty far.
We're in 23 states. Okay. That doesn't mean we're shipping pallets. Some of them, Wyoming is a controlled state. They order a case every once in a while. Mm. California is a little more than that. You know, pallets go out to California. But yeah, we are focusing now back on Colorado again to grow it even more. Okay. We're excited about that. You know, talking about, I had an article a while ago and someone asked me, I forget what the question was, but my response was, Kentucky fired the first shot, Tennessee heard the rapport, and Colorado joined the fight.
So, absolutely.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Michael, I know you've got a stop coming up here soon. And before we let you go, we want to talk about our Angel Share segment where we talk about giving back to community. Giving back to community is big for Ryan and I. We're both foster parents. We both adopted kids.
Awesome.
We're heavily involved in our local communities and churches and stuff. And so that's something that's big and near and dear to our hearts. And I understand it is to you guys as well. So I'd love for you guys to talk about your Tough Enough to Wear Pink initiatives that you helped out with the Cattlemen's Drives out there, or Cattlemen's Day, excuse me. And you've had a relationship with them since 2016, as I understand. And you guys have helped them raise a lot of money. Tell us more about that and some of the benchmarks you guys have done for them.
Yeah, so we give to the community. So anybody reaches out to us that has an event to raise money, we donate a bottle to some kind of something for them to put in an auction. We have a little bit of a criteria, but not much. We just want to make sure that we raise money for that. And it was interesting. I saw Todd Hood on Buckhorn the other on my hike. He was riding bikes, and we'd given him a bottle for fundraising for a biking community thing. And he goes, "We raised $2,000, so thank you." You know, but to get back to tough enough to wear pink. That came about. Dean Dillon wrote Tennessee Whiskey, famous songwriter, wrote tons of George Strait's number ones, over 700 or something. And he was having a movie launched about him or something like documentary. Somebody asked us to donate whiskey. So Philip Raleigh, my senior VP, went out to do the tasting or whatever at the movie, was standing outside smoking a cigarette. And there was this long-haired guy with a cowboy hat, and he's like, "What are you doing here?" And Philip's like, "Well, some guy's got a movie about him, you know, and he's a, you know, musician or something." And Dean's like, "That'd be me." And so we became friends, Philip with Dean, and then went and they were raising money for Adaptive Sports and Tough Enough to Wear Pink in Crest Butte. And so they do a music festival, singer-songwriter music festival. And so we started donating whiskey for that, tastings, getting people liquored up. So when they have the auction, they just crack open that wallet and, you know, and give money. And then we've done a pink label that's only sold in Crest Butte. And we take money from that. And we either buy stuff at the auction or donate or whatever. So we give back in that way. But mainly just support in any way we can, in the sense of dinners where they have singer songwriters, we show up there. We'll be in an auction and they'll be doing, you know, auction off, a night with, Marla Cannon, you know, Josh, all these singer songwriters that have written for a bunch of really famous, you know, musicians and really famous songs. And they'll do a night and we'll throw in, you know, they'll get up to a certain point, you know, $30,000 for that night or whatever. We'll throw in three cases of whiskey and Philip will make cocktails that night and it'll go to $40,000. So, yeah. So,
but what is Tough Enough to Wear Pink specifically?
Tough Enough to Wear Pink is originally raising money for breast cancer, but it's all cancers in the Gunnison Valley area. It's a nationwide thing, but Gunnison Valley Hospital is, we've raised a lot of money for them, bought a couple of really amazing—
Near $5 million, as I understand, is that correct?
Yeah, amazing machines.
That's awesome.
Where they don't, where people that have, are going through cancer don't have to go to Denver. If they do, there's a couple of cars to ferry them up there. There's places for them to stay.
It's a huge support network and stuff to help support
it is.
Care. Yeah. That's awesome.
My sister-in-law actually had breast cancer, and in Montrose, there's a, I don't remember the name of it, breast cancer research hospital thing that they started there. That's part of all that. So
she's a beneficiary of the program.
Near and dear to my heart, yeah. That's She actually had, I think, right before we started supporting, but it's very important to me that we support to all that. Yep. So, yeah.
Very cool.
I'm going out on a limb. I think everybody's had some kind of brush with cancer.
Absolutely.
Somehow touched by it. Yep. And so it's not just breast cancer. It's let's help anybody that's been in that, position. So.
Right. But before I go, I have one question. What do we have to do to get Sam Elliott to be tasting your whiskey on his Netflix show?
Well, he does.
He does?
On the ranch, yeah.
He does?
Yeah.
Do they show your label and all that stuff?
On the ranch, yeah.
Yep.
Wow. Look for it.
It's on there a lot. It's also on Ozarks. It's on episode 3.
I have to write that down so I can go back.
Season absolutely. Three, episode 3 and season 4, episode 6. Laura Linney is with her brother and she pops the bottle and they pour a drink there. That's season 3. And then season 4, she pours it and takes it to her daughter and says, this is some of the good stuff. And her daughter goes, if you say so, Mom.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So
yeah, you can catch 291 on the ranch on Netflix and Ozarks, which is also on Netflix, right?
Yeah.
That's awesome. Awesome. Well, cheers, guys.
Cheers.
Thank you for joining us today.
Yeah. Cheers, guys. Nice to meet you guys.
Yeah.
Yep. Awesome. Well, we just wrapped up an awesome interview with Eric and Michael here at Distillery 291. And right now, Eric is going to guide us through a tasting of his whiskeys here.
Yeah, so Eric, tell us about the first whiskey
we're going to try. We'll do a few. We've got a lot of different whiskeys here. We're going to start with our flagship. This is our 291 Barrel Proof Single Barrel Colorado Whiskey. This is a rye whiskey. You won't see rye on the front label. Michael loves rye whiskeys. And when he set out to start making whiskey, he wanted to make a really Western, rugged, full-bodied rye whiskey. One of his favorite rye whiskeys is Thomas Handy. He took inspiration from that, but he really wanted this to be one of the things he was most well-known for contributing to the Colorado whiskey world, and so that's why we just call it our Colorado whiskey. But it's our barrel-proof rye. We'll start with this. It's going to be a single barrel, so every barrel is going to be slightly different. This particular barrel is 1080, and the proof on this one is a little high. It's 134.8 proof, so very, very full-bodied. Let me pour some for you guys. There you go.
Thanks, sir.
You're welcome.
I'll take that one.
All right. So this whiskey, all these whiskeys we're going to be tasting are Aspen Stave finish. That is something we talked about in the interview. We were the first and only distillery for the longest time to use aspen as a finishing wood on our whiskey. And with this rye, one thing we like to say is it's kind of a bourbon drinker's rye. It's going to be a little bit sweeter, a little less herbal than, you know, some ryes that you might get out of Indiana or some even some ryes that you'll be getting in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. Definitely got the spice on there.
Yeah. But for a barrel proof rye, it's very easy on the nose. Full of, you could smell, there's a lot coming off, but it's not harsh.
A lot of cinnamon stick, a lot of toffee. Mm-hmm. Get a little bit, so with some our whiskey, you tend to, a little brown sugar, yeah, you tend to get a little bit of pine sap or eucalyptus. There tends to be a little bit of a herbal or floral bite. I get a little potpourri on this, but overall, it's actually a pretty sweet rye whiskey on the nose and on the palate.
So. It's got all the nose you expect out of a typical rye, you know.
Yeah, and so also
Christmas notes, right?
I should say too that our rye, this mash bill, 61% malted rye, 39% corn. So it's a two-grain rye, and we use malted rye. All the rye that we use in our distillery is malted. That goes back to how Michael first started making his recipes, and we've carried that forward ever since. Most of our rye is coming from Germany right now. We've also done a lot of experiments with different local Colorado ryes, different varietals, and different malting, and they all taste so different. So we're doing some experiments with that at the moment.
And with that heavy corn too, that's going to be it's going to be sweeter than a lot of the ones that are a lot more barley.
Yes. Right? Cheers.
Cheers.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, this is our flagship. I'd say we're most known for our rye whiskeys.
Great.
Bourbon's a bigger category, and so we do sell more bourbon than our rye. But, you know, we won World's Best Rye, as Michael said, in 2018 at the World Whiskey Awards. 2 years prior to that, we won Best American Rye, but didn't quite win World's Best that year. We've won lots of different awards with our rye whiskey, and it's really helped put us on the map. And there's a lot of people out there when we, you know, go to events, when I do tastings with people, that they're like, I'm a bourbon drinker, I'm not really a rye drinker. And if we just say, hey, peer pressure them a little bit. Just give this a try. You don't have to like it. 9 times out of 10, they'll taste it. And if they're not a rye drinker, this is usually what converts them.
It's got that heavy spice without being spicy. There is that heat that you get from the rye that's really pleasant, but it's not overwhelming like a lot of ryes can be.
Yeah.
That's a very nice.
And this is a very high proof. This is our, like I said, our barrel proof single barrel. We do have a small batch version of this. It's a batch of about 22 to 24 smaller format barrels. And it's going to be 101.7 proof. So we'll cut that down a little bit. You can find these whiskeys pretty much everywhere. But if you're not sure about barrel proof, I'd recommend our small batch. But I mean, we love our barrel proof whiskey.
Absolutely.
Here. Actually, all the whiskeys we're going to be tasting right now are going to be barrel proof whiskeys.
They're fantastic.
So, yeah. Yeah. And it's barrel proof, but it's not super hot. Just the spice is just pleasant. Yeah,
very smooth. Yeah. Yes. Very, very much. That's pleasant.
How do you guys feel about rye whiskey in general?
I love rye.
I started out in Scotch.
Yeah.
So when I moved into rye was kind of a natural fit there. I love the complex.
So if you like that, let me guess, you like Islay Scotches, PD?
Yes,
full bodied. If you like a full bodied rye whiskey.
I do like Highland though as well. Like,
Of course.
Islay, I'm not initially a big heavy smoke.
Sure.
So at Islay, they like the heavy smoke.
I can't get enough of that stuff, man.
Yeah.
I love my Islay Scotch. I love my rye whiskey, my bourbon.
That's very good.
Love it all. All right. So speaking of bourbon, that's what I'm pouring now. Basically, the bourbon version of what we just drank. It's our barrel proof single barrel 291 Colorado bourbon whiskey, finished with Aspenwood staves.
Nice.
Again, single barrel. So this particular barrel we're tasting is 1,115. And the proof is 132.5. Again, a very big proof whiskey here. So with our bourbon, as opposed to the rye, you're going to get maybe a little more orange marmalade or dried fruits, maybe a little dried apricot in there.
Yeah.
Maybe a touch less cinnamon, but maybe more of an herbal tea note in there. Definitely brown sugar, a lot of dried fruit though on there.
Yeah.
With our bourbon though, because typically with our whiskey, you get a touch of that pine sap or eucalyptus, like I was saying. There's always definitely a little bit of cinnamon. The aspen actually helps with that bright note on the front, that cinnamon bite. Sometimes it comes across as minty. There's a nice long woody finish on a lot of our whiskeys. The aspen helps with that.
Right.
Because of that, there are some bourbon drinkers who are used to just really sweet Kentucky bourbons.
Mm-hmm.
They taste this and it's not quite as sweet as what they might be used to.
Right.
So like where I was saying, our rye whiskey appeals to people who didn't think they would like a rye, that like sweeter whiskeys.
Mm-hmm.
Our bourbon actually appeals to rye drinkers or people who aren't as a fan of, really sweet bourbons. They're like, bourbon's not really my thing. Some Scotch people that are into those heavier, full-bodied Islay Scotches, we give them our bourbon, and they really like that a lot.
Yeah, so. It's funny you mentioned poopery on the...
Not poopery. Potpourri.
Yeah.
Poopery is that product that you spray in the toilet.
That was a slip.
Yeah.
Poopery on the rye. I actually picked that up on here with that dried fruit note you talked about.
I'm picking up some of that, the aspen stave too, the toasted aspen stave.
Mm-hmm.
Smokiness.
So in the finish, that woody note, that aspen really helps with that. But it's not overpoweringly woody. It actually just is a soft finish.
Yeah.
Again, for 132 proof, it's a relatively soft-bodied whiskey. Very viscous, very oily, but not the overpowering heat that you get on the back end. You can't get some higher proof whiskeys. And our bourbon here, we like to call this our bottle bling, or if you're a fan of Office Space, it's our bottle flair.
Yeah, your flair. 37 pieces.
Flair.
Absolutely.
I can't fit 37 pieces on here, but we've won so many awards over the years. Our rye won 98 points at IWSC. Our bourbon here is 197 points. Double platinum, double gold at the San Francisco World Whiskey World Spirits Competition. All kinds of stuff. We won. Just last year with World Whiskey Awards, we won Icons Whiskey Craft Producer of the Year just for across our line of whiskeys.
Right.
So fantastic award-winning bourbon. These are, I would say, our two kind of flagship products, our bourbon and our rye. We make most of them. I should tell you, too. Sorry to interrupt.
No, it's okay.
For anybody that's curious about the mash bill, this one is 80% corn, 19% malted rye, 1% malted barley. Just a touch of malted barley in there. Mostly... the corn and the rye.
So. I feel like this is spicier than the rye, the heat on it.
Yeah, it kind of depends. Depends on the barrel. Every barrel is going to be a little bit different, especially with the single barrel. I'd say our bourbon does tend to be a little sweeter, but again, it's not as sweet as when someone hears the word bourbon.
Uh-huh.
Oh, that's going to be really sweet.
Yeah.
But this is definitely more of a summer drinking whiskey to me. And the rye, we're recording this, it's snowing outside right now.
Right, yeah.
And I can't get enough of our rye in the wintertime.
And that's a good choice there. I mean, the... there are some honey notes and stuff in there as well. And I think that the finish, uncommon to I think a lot of bourbons, is it lingers for a while. Yeah. The oily finish that you mentioned, mm-hmm. it's not necessarily something you're going to get out of a lot of bourbons. You're going to get that more of the complex rise and scotches, stuff like that. Yeah. I really like that. That's a good finish. I like that.
Thank you. And I should also say that our bourbon here, we also have a small batch version of this. Again, 22, 24-ish barrels in a batch. And we're going to proof it down to 100 proof.
Okay.
50% ABV. The same mash bill. Just we're going to proof it down a little bit. And yeah, you can find that pretty much everywhere. So that's awesome. And while we're on bourbons, the next thing we'll be tasting is what's known as our Bad Guy Bourbon, our 291 Bad Guy Colorado Bourbon Whiskey. This is a seasonal release that we release once a year, every October. And this is batch 9 that we're tasting. This is this year's release. It is a 4-grain bourbon, and wheat is the second most prominent grain. So we call it our 4-grain wheated bourbon. And this one, we go into the barrel at a slightly lower entry proof. It's also still going to be barrel proof. But this one came out at 120.6 proof after aging. And this particular batch, batch 9, we only got 1,400 bottles out of it. So it's just a small little batch every year that we make. And yeah, it's a lot of fun for us.
And how long are you aging these?
So most of our whiskey is going to be aged in these smaller 10-gallon barrel format. That was kind of a necessary consequence of how Michael started. He started in 300 square feet, didn't have a lot of room for barrels, also was bootstrapping it, and so needed to age whiskey as quickly as possible.
Oh, yeah.
It's difficult to age whiskey in small barrels. Most people thought you could not make great whiskey in small barrels. Obviously, talked about our awards. We've figured out how to do it. It has got to make great white whiskey to be able to go into the barrel, a small barrel. So with this size, we're aging a minimum of 1 year up to around 2 years. Most of the whiskey we're harvesting these days is about 2 years old.
Okay.
Sometimes we'll even go a little over 2 years in a 10-gallon barrel. We've got some 30 and 53-gallon barrels aging as well right now. But
yeah,
minimum of 1 year. Yeah. These days,
it doesn't taste
much,
young.
It's all pretty much right young. Around 2 years. Yeah. Mm. So I should say our Bad Guy Bourbon here, this started as actually a mash bill that Michael was experimenting with. And he had a buddy who had a restaurant here in town and was looking for kind of his house whiskey, like a house mash that was his own. And so Michael had this, kind of gave him this recipe. Michael made it, barreled it for him, all that stuff. And the name comes from the son of that restaurant owner. He had a young son at the time, and son said, you should call it Bad Guy Whiskey, because bad awesome. Guys drink whiskey. And yeah. Michael, you know, being an artist, he's like, that's perfect. Bad Guy Bourbon, there's a ring to that, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So Michael's like, you have to name it that. So we really made this, you know, Michael was working on this recipe anyway, but they got our first batch of it, this restaurant here in town. And eventually it reverted back to us. And so we just started releasing it to the public. But it was really kind of, Michael originally thought it was just either going to be a one-off or something we made just for them. But I'm personally happy that we were able to release it to everybody. And stuff. So it's going to be a little bit sweeter than the previous bourbon.
Yeah,
right. Wheat helps soften it out. The mash bill on this one is 59% corn, 29% malted white wheat, 9% malted rye, and 3% malted barley.
Okay. I've been nosing this one. The nose is good. There's caramel sweetness to it, but there's like graham cracker and stuff in there too. And it smells awesome. I'm just like enjoying the nose of this one.
Yeah. It's a little ironic. The name, you know, Michael heard the name from, you know, that guy's son and wanted to name it that, because it's such a great name, Bad Guy Bourbon. But it's softer and sweeter and more delicate,
at this proof, sure.
than our other bourbon. And so it's just funny that our sweeter, softer bourbon is kind of, you know, named Bad Guy Bourbon when it's really not harsh at all.
But you guys are at heart, right?
Yeah. We're a bunch of softies. You guys almost made Michael cry in his interview. Which is not hard, because he's a wonderful softie at heart. But
you know, you catch Michael on the street. He's a tall guy. He's big, tall, and you could totally catch him like look wearing all black. Like he like kind of presents that bad guy kind of. But you start talking to him, he is a softie. Oh, yeah. This is a pretty good representation of Michael right here.
So flavor profile again. Each batch we do one a year. You know, it's going to vary a little bit batch to batch. But this particular one, I get some creme brulee, some vanilla custard, a little bit of Fuji apple note on there. Mm-hmm. It's just nice and sweet.
Yeah, so creme brulee is. I smell that. Yeah.
Okay, so I have one more special treat to taste.
Oh, geez.
This is actually what you guys, we were drinking. Well, I had something different in my glass at the time, but what you guys had in your glass during the interview, this is not released yet. It is a 4-grain rye whiskey. Michael wanted, he was just curious to see what would happen with it. So we took this bad guy recipe, the 59 corn, 29 wheat, 9 rye, and 3 barley. He took that and he wanted to flip it on its head and make a rye whiskey out of it. So he flip-flopped the corn percentages and the rye percentages to make it a rye whiskey, but with wheat, malted white wheat being the second most prominent grain.
Okay.
I had never heard of a 4-grain rye, let alone a 4-grain rye where wheat was the second most prominent grain and not corn. So
we don't even 4-grain bourbons, stuff like that, right?
But we're not sure what we're even calling this yet. We're not sure if it's going to be an E or if it's going to be a separate release, you know, with its own kind of label or what. This is just something that Michael and I are both really excited about, and you guys are some of the first people who get to taste this stuff.
Fantastic.
Oh, I know.
I just pulled this out of the barrel today.
You didn't describe it very well in our previous engagement here, but I really enjoyed it. So I'm looking forward to tasting this again.
And this is 122 proof. Like I said, just pulled it out of the barrel today, took a proof on it. And great. Again, very sweet for a rye whiskey. I wouldn't say overpoweringly sweet. It's still a rye at heart.
In a lot of those floral.
Floral notes, yep. A little bit of potpourri or baby's breath. There's still a little bit of that eucalyptus, but I also get a little bit of like red licorice. And stay with me here. Like, did you guys ever have the brown sugar cinnamon Pop-Tarts as a kid?
Oh, those are my favorite.
That was my favorite Pop-Tart as a kid.
I don't care for those.
I love toaster strudel, but I wasn't
after this, you gotta go buy a box.
If I wasn't having toaster strudel, it was the brown sugar cinnamon Pop-Tarts. And this has that note in there.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
You know, I grew up on my mom making a Stollen bread. It's a traditional German pastry bread, and I'm picking up notes of that out of this, which
awesome.
Is
awesome.
Which is
I have no reference point for that, but that sounds
I mean, I'm like, wow,
if it smelled like this, then I would like that.
Well, and typical with the rye, right? Christmas, the spice. It's
it's a little bit of dried apple on the finish on this one. Yeah. So what's interesting? We're tasting this. I just pulled this out of the barrel. We haven't actually done an Aspen stave finish on this yet. Right now it's 2.5 years old. Probably going to let it age a little bit longer.
I can really tell in the other ones, the spice that the Aspen adds to it.
Hoping that, you know, it might get released this year. Might not. I don't know. You guys just have to wait and see. But right now it's still aging and we haven't done the Aspen finish on it. So
there's a lot more oak on the finish on this one than I am on your others.
A little more oak.
Is that just because of how fresh it is? Or do you think that's going to impart itself to the final product?
It depends. It could be part of the age. Typically, though, we can age it 3-4 years easily without getting over-oaked.
It's definitely not over-oaked. It's just those nice notes.
The Aspen can kind of soften that. Adds a woodiness, but it's a difficult thing to describe. It kind of softens and lengthens that finish, whereas this one I feel like right now is dropping off a little bit more compared to what we've tasted.
Yeah,
it kind of adds a harder stop to the finish.
Yeah.
Part of that is we haven't done the finishing process yet to the whiskey. So.
Certainly that first bourbon we tried had a lot longer finish than the first rye, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's very good, though.
Yeah, as I continue to drink it, I'm getting a lot more dried apple, dried fruit on it. A very sweet whiskey.
I mean,
spice, too. Yeah. Like you ever had those baked cinnamon apples?
Yeah.
Grandma used to make them, like they turn red. You throw cinnamon on the apple slices in the oven.
Yeah, yeah.
Get a little bit of that on the palate.
Apple pie almost, right? Yeah. Without necessarily the sweetness, but, you know, the first rye we try is fantastic. Everything else is great too, but it's between your normal rye and this one to be the ones that I would write home about. this is really good.
Cool.
Yeah,
I can't wait to try this one once it's finished and you guys are bottling it.
That'll be great. Pick up a bottle of that for sure.
I'm happy to drink more with you guys, but we'll do it off camera.
Well, you heard him. Thank you so much for watching. Eric, thank you so much for guiding us. And cheers.
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 Thank you for joining us on Whiskey Wanderlust. Subscribe to the show on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and all other major podcast platforms. And be sure to leave us a rating and review. Follow us on social media and visit us online at whiskeywanderlust.co.